Good morning. Please take your seats. We'd like to get started. Good morning. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I am Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. I hope you are enjoying this year's NLC so far. Together with the practice group team and our executive committee leaders, it has been a thrill to help to put together the largest conference in the Society's history. Please do give a round of applause to our practice group leadership for all their hard work in making this weekend possible. Quick show of hands, who is at the convention for the first time? Very good, welcome to the NLC. How many of you have come for more than 10 years? Excellent. 20? Wow. And I think there are several who've been here more than 30 years, is that right? Excellent. Truly amazing. The Federalist Society is nothing without our great members, and I want you to know on behalf of the practice groups how grateful we are for what you have done and will continue to do to improve our state, the state of our nation's legal order. Turning to the business at hand, it is a pleasure to kick off our next great session. For this fireside chat, we are delighted to welcome the former Solicitor General of West Virginia, Elbert Lin, and United States Senator Eric Schmidt from Missouri. The Senator is on a tight time schedule, and we have 45 minutes set for this conversation, so I will be very brief. Elbert will introduce the Senator, but I do want to express on behalf of the Society our gratitude to the Senator and his excellent staff for making this fireside chat possible. Elbert Lin is a partner at Hunton Andrews Kurth, where he serves as chair for issues and appeals. We are grateful that he is also the chair of the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Executive Committee, which benefits greatly from his great leadership. And with that, I will cut it very short. Please join me in welcoming Elbert and Senator Eric Schmidt.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Nate. And I appreciate the Federalist Society giving me the privilege to be here this morning with Senator Schmidt. And thank you, Senator, for taking the time out of what is obviously a very busy week. So for a lot of reasons, including that I, too, am just a kid from the Midwest, I'm looking forward to talking to you. But before we get started, let me tell the audience just a little bit about your background. So the Senator is a sixth-generation Missourian. He was born and raised in Bridgeton, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis. His grandfather was a butcher, and his father worked for decades at the Anheuser-Busch Brewery, a place that I visited as a kid, which is probably bad parenting. Senator Schmidt is a graduate of Truman State University and St. Louis University School of Law. He has served in local government, state government, and federal government. His public service began as an alderman for Glendale, Missouri from 2005 to 2008. He then served as a member of the Missouri Senate from 2009 to 2017. After that, Senator Schmidt won election to be the 46th state treasurer, which he was from 2017 until in 2019 he became the 43rd Attorney General of Missouri. He was Attorney General for one full term and then was elected in the fall of 2022 to the U.S. Senate, where he now serves. So I'd like to start with just, you spent almost all of your adult life in public service, and more specifically in elected office. I'm interested in what motivated you and what continues to motivate you to do that.
So, well, thank you for having me, and it is a special occasion. I'm wearing my Missouri boots, so you know when I'm wearing these, it's a big deal. So I'm here. I killed an alligator at Jeff Landry's alligator hunt and turned him into boots with a state seal, so I'm happy to be here. Although Jeff, anyway, I won't get into, there's a lot of Jeff Landry stories I won't get into. But yeah, so for me, I grew up in a working class neighborhood in as you mentioned, the suburbs of St. Louis. I didn't know any lawyers growing up at all. But for whatever reason, at a pretty young age, the law interested me because I felt like it kind of gave guardrails for people to pursue their dreams. And so I had that. I was educated by the Jesuits. Don't hold that against me. But there was sort of this DeSmet Jesuit High School, Men for Others. So there's this sort of aspect of service that was kind of woven into my DNA at a young age. But it really wasn't until I became a dad. I was a lawyer. I was a practicing lawyer, just made partner at a relatively young age. And Stephen was born. And Stephen was born with a rare genetic condition called tuberous sclerosis. Stephen, to this day, he's 20s, nonverbal, a lot of challenges. And he has epilepsy, which is the sort of the biggest medical challenge. And he would have seizures, still does, and had a four-hour seizure when he was, you know, a baby. And going through that with Stephen was sort of I kind of went through this process of discernment, what do you really want to do? And so I loved practicing law, but I thought, you know, public service was a way for me to do a little bit more. And it's led me to this place here today. It's still, quite frankly, I pinch myself sometimes. But I've just tried to work really hard. But I think Stephen was, in the experience with my son, it was sort of the catalytic event that got me involved. And he's still an inspiration to me this day.
I mentioned briefly at the outset that we share sort of Midwestern roots. Do you think you've carried any of your sort of Midwestern values with you? Has that sort of informed who you are as a public servant?
Absolutely. I think that Missouri in particular, where I'm from, is always kind of been, it's the show me state, right? So sort of skeptical of a government 1,000 miles away telling us how to live our lives. And that independent kind of streak is certainly, I'm kind of a natural contrarian anyway. And so I think that those sort of values of questioning things was woven into me wanting to be a lawyer in many ways, but certainly now, in particularly when I was Attorney General and now being in the United States Senate, that colors how I view things and why I'm thankful for the separation of powers, these sort of structures that protect individual liberty and freedom. And I carry that with me now. So from my perspective, I want to diffuse as much of that. I didn't come here to aggregate more. I think we ought to be allowing states to experiment in these laboratories of democracy. So I do think that kind of, and I think there's a lot of humility in the Midwest, and we need a little bit more of that, I think, in Washington.
Similar question. One of the things that I found so fascinating about your background is that you've spent time at all different levels of government. I've always been a very strong believer that you don't really know what something is like until you've walked a mile in someone's shoes. So I'm interested in how that has informed, you know, your public service, your outlook on government as you've kind of gone through the system.
Yeah, I think we don't teach civics really that much anymore to grade school kids, and we should. We'll be replacing these ridiculous sort of struggle sessions that often happen in our public schools now with civics. Because I think that if you understand, and I actually, when I was first elected to statewide office, I went back to my alma mater at St. Louis University and taught a class. I went to one of the Jesuits that I knew and said, hey, I really kind of want to understand better what's going on college campuses, because this is nuts. And it had to do a lot with sort of conservatives being put in sort of the bleachers when it came to this open forum of supposed to be free speech at a time where people should be learning about new ideas. And so I wanted to be with students, and so it was called 21st Century American Civics, and it was law students, it was upperclassmen and women. And for me, the takeaway was that I think once people, and some took the class because they wanted to argue with me, some took it because they agreed with me, and some people didn't know who I was, and whatever the reason was. But I think the takeaway for me was, even at that age, I think once people have an understanding of what the purpose of government really is, and that we are endowed by our Creator with certain rights, and government's purpose is to protect those rights, that you can have disagreements on policy, but you don't question the very nature of the experiment. And I think what's troubling, what you see now, a lot of these protests on college campuses, and so it's sort of, if you don't have those anchors, if you don't have the shared belief system in what this experiment is all about, that's sort of the point for cultural Marxists, right? It's sort of the point. They want to untether from family and faith and the things that sort of bind us together, because we're a creedal nation, right? We believe in something. That's what binds us together. If you can separate that, that's a real problem. And so for me, I think
having served in local, state, and federal government, I think what I try to tell students or people who ask is that, you know, the states created the federal government. It's not federal, state, local, right? The states unanimously agreed to what the limited powers of the federal government should be. And any that they didn't grant, they retained themselves. And local governments, and this kind of came up during COVID, I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit, local governments are political subdivisions of the state. They're granted specific powers. So the states kind of reign supreme in this, you know, this system that we have. And I think if you understand, and I want to remind my colleagues sometimes in the federal government of that dynamic, that it's often lost because there's just this tendency, which is human nature, to aggregate and exercise power, which is why our founders were, you know, such geniuses, because they understood that and they created a system, federalism, separation of powers, that you know, vertically and horizontally was meant to protect liberty. And I think the more that we talk about that to younger people, the more that we talk to our friends and neighbors in an interesting way, I guess, if that's possible. I just think that's the path. That's the path forward for us.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, your point about education is right spot on, because it's got to start with the kids. They've got to understand it. Just as an aside, I think when my kid was, I can't remember what it was, in elementary school, and they were taught that the role of the Supreme Court is to do justice, and I almost lost my mind, yeah. Right? It's like, who do I complain to about this? But
it's emphatically the province of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be, right?
Right. And to so that, I think that's a good time to transition to your time as Attorney General. So as most in this room know, state AGs have become a huge thorn in the side of the federal government, and frankly, on both sides of it, right? I mean, we saw it, Obama, Trump, Biden. You were one such thorn, a particularly big one. Was that part of your motivation to be Attorney General?
Yeah, I thought, so it's interesting, my time, the first 2 years Trump was in office, second 2 years Biden's in office, and you got COVID right in between. So it was a fascinating period of time to be an Attorney General. And early on, actually, I had a conversation with Jonathan Bunch and Leonard about, you know, what a Republican AG 2.0 looked like. Because I thought it was a pretty unique time to come in and be an innovator in that way. And for me, we kind of viewed it as protecting the citizens of our state from government overreach at the federal level, at the state level. So we didn't, in any of our briefs, we didn't argue that any agencies should be given deference. Like, we sort of changed the culture, because you defend state agencies as AG too. And then at the local level too. But it was an interesting time, so we kind of had the way that we viewed the world, and we assembled some great talent. John Sauer was my Solicitor General. John Sauer just got named Solicitor General of the United States of America yesterday by President Trump. Jesus is here. We had stellar talent, and you can't do the things that I wanted to do if you did not have hardworking, smart people around you. And so those Midwestern values, I guess that we had a lot of that in our office. But yeah, I viewed it as an opportunity to kind of reshape the order and get us back to the to where we always were going to be, or where we should have been. So we had the more interesting things probably to this audience. I mean, we had Missouri was the first state to file in the vaccine mandate cases. We took that to the Supreme Court and we won. Missouri had the student loan debt forgiveness case because MOHELA was the hook. We had a little-known loan servicing agency called MOHELA that most people never heard about. That whole case came down to standing. We had it. We took that to the Supreme Court, and we won. And we also had a case that many probably have heard of, Missouri versus Biden, that became Murphy versus Missouri. And what's interesting about that case is that was honestly one of the funnest things we worked on, because we were just workshopping this idea. We saw Jen Psaki was up there saying, we're flagging stuff for Facebook. They wanted to create a disinformation governance board. And so I talked about that contrarian in me. This was a trigger. We thought there was something there And we filed the case. We partnered with my friend, Jeff Landry. And we filed the case. And one of the interesting tactical decisions we made is we sought discovery before the preliminary injunction or TRO. And when we got that granted, this is before Elon Musk bought Twitter, by the way, before Twitter files, before Jim Jordan's doing all of his great work exposing this, the discovery that we got back was frightening. I mean, these were top-level cabinet officials coordinating, colluding, coercing some of the biggest companies in the history of the world to suppress speech. And so for me, I've always viewed the First Amendment as this beating heart of the Constitution. I would give years ago when I'd get asked to do commencement speeches, before I became so controversial, I was asked to do those things. I would talk about the First Amendment. And I would talk about, you know, it is important for you to defend the ideas that are the ability for somebody to articulate ideas you vehemently disagree with. I think that's just really important. And so this case then landed sort of in the heart of this really important debate. And I think, you know, that being exposed in that case was kind of emblematic of the approach that we took. We tried to be aggressive. We tried to be smart. We tried to win. And I think we scored some pretty important wins in that time as AG.
It's such a target-rich environment, still is today, hopefully won't be in a little bit. But how do you go about deciding? I mean, you have limited resources, right? I mean, you've got a bunch of killers who are working for you, but they can only do so many cases. How do you go about figuring out what those targets are and which ones are important to spend your time on?
Well, we had as a lot of offices do now, we created a special litigation unit. It was sort of like nimble. During COVID in particular, I would get trouble from some of my other AG friends because Jeff Landry would say, "Oh, why are you suing all these school districts? You're making me look bad."
That's a pretty good.
I went from not being able to understand Jeff to being able to imitate him to some degree. But we sued 64 school districts in Missouri because they were continuing to force kids to wear masks all day long. And so, you know, some of it's driven by, you know, the culture that you establish, and we wanted to be innovative. We wanted to take on overreach. And that was the COVID times were very instructive. I mean, I think people often say power corrupts. I think power reveals. And when people who never should have had it in the first place got it, they were willing to do a lot of things that I think when we look back, and certainly at many people at the time, could hardly believe this was happening. You know, quelling dissent, and it gets into the sort of Missouri versus Biden lawsuit too, but you had people who would stand up there at the podium on Monday and tell people that they could go outside or not. You know, they were bulldozing in sand into skate parks. They were you know, putting police, you know, tape around playgrounds. I mean, this is nuts. And what I found was that the more we did those things, the reporters couldn't believe it. I mean, in fact, reporters, when we were suing all these school districts, they weren't even in person back in their newsrooms to interview you. They were on FaceTime in their cars with masks on. And here's this guy saying, "No, we're going to liberate the kids and, you know, parents should be able to make these decisions." So culturally, I think it's a really interesting experiment of what people will go along with and who's going to fight back. And to this day, when I go around Missouri, the most frequent comment that I'll get, particularly from moms, is "Thank you for standing up for us." You know, because a lot of people felt that way. It's the same way, honestly, in hearings now. I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and I ask about some of these ridiculous DEI initiatives. And by the way, this election, President Trump got a mandate. People were rejecting this stuff, too. They had sort of had enough of being told that, you know, our Army, which is supposed to be the most lethal warfighting machine in the world, that's been the greatest example of a meritocracy in our nation's history, is somehow we're going to divide the room by race. And welcome to your struggle session. You know, this is nuts. And I think that this election cycle proved that you know, normal can win. And I just think we've got to be courageous and step up and fight back. And so that's been the ethos of whether I was AG or now the job that I have.
I like the line, normal can win. I mean, when we talked about the election in our household, it's people just wanted the government to stop doing weird stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
So I want to back up a little to the theoreticals. I mean, it's interesting. You've talked about, you know, the states being, you've got, as you executed in your time as the AG, you got to check the federal government, but you've also got to check the subdivisions of the state. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, like, theoretical criticism and debate about the role that state AGs are playing and how aggressive they are. I mean, do you have sort of a vision for how state AGs fit into sort of the constitutional structure?
I think state AGs are tip of the spear. I think that they are the mechanism by which, the instrument by which that our liberties can be protected. Because in many instances, there's nobody else that either has the resources or the standing to pursue challenges that are going to matter or defend things. Right now, we're about to enter a phase. You know, I like to think that we sort of had a playbook to fight back. The Democrats are going to try to borrow that playbook. But the good news is we have sort of I think we have the law on our side, which should matter, especially to this crowd. But yeah, I think that the next phase of that is, you know, there are going to be a lot of defending decisions that are made. And I also think, you know, the Department of Justice has lost so much credibility because of the weaponization we've seen, whether it's trying to throw the chief political opponent in jail for the rest of his life or going after Catholics or going after moms who showed up to school board meetings under the auspices of the Patriot Act. I mean, so a lot of this stuff, this wasn't just some local mayor, you know, boarding up a basketball rim. It was the Attorney General of the United States saying, we think traditional Catholics might be terrorists. This is the United States of America. And I think that we need to fight back. And the AGs are in a really good position to go do that. And I also think that the talent you can get in a state AG office, you're a great example. Sauer's a great example. I mean, there's a bunch of examples out there. You can attract talent of people who want to go make a difference. Are they making less money? Yeah. But they might become a federal judge or solicitor general of the United States someday too, right? But there's a great deal of sort of community in that world. And I was brief, you know, I was on the executive board of Republican AG Association, briefly chair before I had to step down to run for this job. But I think that you kind of feel like you're in it together and fighting these important fights, and you share ideas, and that really matters. Also, as a shout out to the Federalist Society, the left has captured almost every cultural institution that there is. It's like Hollywood, you know, everything. But the Federalist Society, you know, for decades now, we're better at this than them, of sort of having this community and culture of jurists and people who believe, you know, that the law should be interpreted as it's written, not what it should be. And I think the intersection of that, whether you want to call it a bench or farm team or whatever, with President Trump coming in office in 2016, we were able to, a lot of the victories that we were able to score when I was AG is because of that. Because of that. So, and we're going to have an opportunity to do that again. I mean, Missouri's got 5 district court judges coming up, the 8th Circuit, you know, so there's a lot of opportunities now with President Trump being in office and the immense amount of talent that's out there of people that want to serve on the federal bench, again, to protect our liberties. So it's just a shout out to FedSoc for all the work they've done over the years.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about how you recruited, because, I mean, sort of hit the jackpot with John Sauer, right? But, you know, with these state AG offices, it can be challenging. You're asking people to move out to the states and, you know, not, sometimes it's leave D.C. or leave wherever they are. What's that pitch? What's the pitch look like?
You know, come join us. We can help change the world, right? And save America. Looking back now, that was a lot of fun. And I probably more than any time in my life had to expend as much social capital as I had gathered over the years, because you were constantly asking, okay, who do you know that would be good at this kind of thing? And I was really lucky. You know, we had some people that came over from the U.S. Attorney's Office. We had just, you know, sort of talented appellate lawyers that wanted to join us. And then what started to happen is we would get people from other parts of the country who saw the work that we were doing, like, oh, that's where I want to go. Like, that's the stuff I want to do. So, it doesn't happen overnight, but I think if you're methodical about it and you sort of share your vision, people want to join you. They just got to know, where to go. And also what happened, too, in that office, you have a lot of people that maybe have been there a while, and they're good lawyers, and they do great work, but you have an opportunity then to kind of have succession planning. And like kind of turned our consumer protection unit that every kind of state AG has, that was really what, the Democrats in the 80s really used a lot for the tobacco and 90s, the tobacco litigation, stuff like that. We kind of turned it into like, how can we fight overregulation? How is this harming consumers? So you have some opportunities to kind of, it's not a 180, but sort of move the ship in a direction I think that's more more in line with what people would expect their lawyer to be doing for them.
I will say personally, I'm very grateful to folks like you, my old boss, Patrick Morrissey, who were open to hiring people who weren't from the state. I could not go home to Illinois and serve in state government.
I don't think they'd hire you. I don't think you'd be on the list.
So,
but I will say one more thing. So all those cases that we had, and we would lead on Amicus West Virginia. And then there's a core group of states, honestly, that would do a lot of the work. And some of it's capacity, some of it's the size of the office. There's a lot of factors that go into play. But I wanted the Chevron case. That's what I wanted, the case that would strike down Chevron, and I didn't get it. But I'm glad it happened. I'm really glad it happened.
Can't have everything, right? Right. So, 2023, you come to D.C., join the Senate. It's a very different role in a lot of different ways, right? One, you're moving from the state to the federal government. It's also maybe something that people consider a little bit less. You're moving from sort of more of an executive function to a policy-making function. What made you decide to run for the Senate?
Well, an open U.S. Senate seat is a pretty rare thing. Roy Blunt had decided to retire after two terms. And for me, making that decision in the early part of 2021, I just felt like this is where all the important fights and debates were going to be. And I think we're at a critical point in our country's history where we're making decisions about who we're going to be. And I just felt like the United States Senate, which is supposed to be the world's most deliberative body, was the place for me. And I feel so, read a lot of history, and the Senate has played a really critical role over the years. It's a pretty uniquely American institution, and I still think it matters, and it's worth fighting for. And now, what you're seeing now is, I just think there's a lot of energy. There's some of the newer members that are coming into, and it's a really unique time, and now that we're in the majority, it'll be very different than my first 2 years. We're sort of like, in the wilderness to some degree. but there's certain things that kind of, I think this audience would appreciate. I think people believe that the United States Senate operates like, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, And when Mr. Schmidt got to Washington, it is not how it works. It's more like Kabuki theater. And Chuck Schumer has hoarded and aggregated power in a way that the Senate was never intended to operate. And so one of the things I think that I'm looking forward to in the coming months is that that members, I think, will be more able to offer amendments on the Senate floor, like have real debate. There are a lot of things that, like takeaways. I didn't know we had lunch together every day. We do. The Republicans conference, we have lunch together. I didn't know that. Nobody tells you that. Which is a great opportunity to really get to know people. The Senate's small enough, you do. But I tell people the negative takeaway was, we were busy a lot, but we didn't do anything. We weren't on the Senate floor. Now Schumer, even in this lame duck session now, is going to want to make sure that he's confirming as many judges as he can before January 20th, January 6th. So that'll be what's on the docket. But again, I think that this idea where members can stand up on the Senate floor, offer amendments, build coalitions, have real, you know, debate, try to persuade is a really important place to get back to, that place how it should operate.
I think it's a sad sign of the times that you got applause for we should debate more.
Yeah, right.
You mentioned the Chevron and Loper Bright. I know one thing that you care a lot about and have focused on in your time in the Senate is separation of powers. You've convened a post, I don't know if it's post Chevron or Loper Bright, you know, working group. Why does that matter to you so much?
So my maiden speech, which used to, you know, 100 years ago, a senator would probably wait like 4 years to give their maiden speech. Now it's like you just pick that when you do it your first year or two. Mine was about, in June of last year, was about the two great challenges I see for our country. One is this sort of erosion of free and open debate, the First Amendment, the willingness of particularly the left to want to shut down speech, demonize the othering of our fellow citizens because they're not, you know, adopting the narrative, the regime's narrative. And you saw that play out with big tech. The second piece was the growth of the administrative state. This is antithetical to the vision of the founders in every way. I mean, the whole idea was that, you know, you would send people there, you could send them back or send them home, but they were accountable to the people in this constitutional republic. And that what we have now is, you know, and you gotta remember the reason why we have separation of powers and federalism was so that no one branch, no one person ever got too powerful, that power was supposed to be dispersed. And the whole purpose of that was to protect individual liberty. That's the design. Well, that fails the test if some deputy undersecretary of an agency you've never heard of can send a guidance letter and ruin somebody's livelihood. Like, that is not supposed to happen, and it happens all the time, all the time. And so for me, the opportunity that exists now in a post-Chevron world, you know, deserves some leadership. I'm not the only person that cares about it, but we, Ethan Harper is my general counsel, is here. We're leading a working group in the Senate. What does that look like? What's the prescription now? Because the concern, I think, is among many, I'm sure people in this room share this, is that if we don't do something in the Article I branch, the Article II branch starts to figure out a way around it, and then the Article III branch comes up with some new deference standard that ultimately has to make its way to the Supreme Court and maybe get struck down again. But we haven't seized on the opportunity again to put power back where it was always intended to be, which is the Article I branch. And so what does that look like? We're listening to a lot of ideas. I mean, I think there's short, intermediate, and long-term goals. There's things you can do on leasing, the permitting, that maybe we even get to do by way of reconciliation because of budget savings in the tax. So there's a lot of those kind of ideas that happen. But I think long-term structural reform looks something like Reins Act, right? It looks something like before whatever the economic impact of some regulation is, and my number would probably be lower than most, but let's just call it $100 million, that if you want a new regulation, Congress has to approve it first. And why is that important? Well, if some, you know, innovative bureaucrat wants to ban gas stoves, right, we should have to vote on that, right? We should have to vote on it. And a couple things would happen. The dynamic would change culturally in the bureaucracies. It would also, the voters could look and see how you voted on these things, and that has its own deterrent for an elected representative of the people. I'm not sure many people would vote for that. Some would. And also, I think they'd think twice about ever promulgating the rule in the first place. And I think that something like, you know, a 3-for-1, we filed legislation to say, look, before you can introduce, or you can, you know, promulgate a new rule, you got to pull back 3. And I think that would have they'd have to look, well, do we really want to do this? Because we really like these 3. We don't want to diminish our power. But I think that there, in the next 4 years, I think that, you know, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and the Doge crew, That'll be an important thing, I think, to highlight some of the waste. I think we've got a unique opportunity in a subject that people's eyes can sort of glaze over, you know, the over-regulation. I think the challenge there is always how do you explain that to people so it's relevant in their lives, you know? But we've got an opportunity, I think, for some short-term wins, but also structural reform, again, to rein in the administrative state. So those were the two big challenges I saw and tried to identify in my maiden speech, and I think they're real, and I think we are in a positive trajectory to address them now that they've been identified and we can work on them.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm glad that if you look at the Supreme Court opinions, right, I mean, I feel like SCOTUS is mostly doing its job, but it's a dialogue, and you can sort of see Justice Gorsuch and others passing the ball back to Congress and saying, you know, there's only so much they can do, but there's a little bit of a message, I think, that, you know, Article I has abdicated its responsibility, right? Write legislation more carefully, whatever it is.
Yes, and willingly so. I mean, the dance you see from a lot of folks is, I voted for the greatest bill in the world, but I can't believe what the EPA just did, you know? Because you've given the EPA so much, the lane by which for them to operate is so broad. And so in some ways, the Article I branch, many members, and they don't really want to do that, right? They want to just say, I voted for the Build Back Better or whatever, And then all of a sudden, you can't build a chips factory because they haven't hired enough ex-convicts to meet their DEI requirements. True story. Or they're not laying broadband down because small contractors haven't come up with their climate action plan. That's why billions have been authorized for broadband in rural America, but it's not being laid because the contractor that wants to do it hasn't, said articulately enough how he wants to address, long-term climate change. It's nuts. It's totally nuts. So I think that, one of the things we're working on is what does legislation look like moving forward that's more prescriptive or doesn't allow the deference that's often granted to these agencies to go out and run wild?
So one of the things I know folks in this room care about who are involved in the Federal Society are judges. How do you approach your advice and consent role? How do you, envision that?
I think we're going to be really busy, which will be good in a few months. Yeah. I think you look at President Trump's first term, and one of the lasting legacies of that are just the phenomenal federal judges, and of course the three Supreme Court judges that he got to name and got confirmed. And it has, unlike the left that is so focused on results, and it's just a result-oriented. I mean, I'm 49, so it's relatively young in the Senate, but it's not that young. In law school, this is late 90s, there's still this, living Constitution rhetoric from law professors. I mean, it still exists. But it shouldn't, because it's that. Hopefully, that ideology is dead. As even Justice Sotomayor said, we're all originalists now, right? So you look at the work that Justice Scalia and Thomas and so many others now. We've changed the game a little bit, right? And because we have smart judges who know what their role is. And so, if you ask a conservative, I know I'm not going to win all that. You just want to have a fair shot, and you want the judge to interpret the laws that's written, not get to an outcome. And I think that was accepted. The left, they just always had that on their side. They had, nine super legislators. Well, not nine, but they had a majority super legislators. So think about how that has changed now, right? Like, they enjoyed this period of time when you saw this explosion in the administrative state. They had control of Congress. A lot of states, and then the ultimate backstop. And if you wonder why now they're losing their minds, because it's changed. It's changed. And so we've got an opportunity, I think, in these 4 years now to, again, put on smart judges and actually continue this framework that's now been set that allows us to compete. I mean, look, you know, the student loan debt forgiveness case, I think it was 5-4. Was it 5-4 or 6-3? 6-3. There's still three justices that, you know, thought that the President of the United States, with the stroke of his pen, could wipe out $500 million worth of debt without any authorization. And again, and now, by the way, people like AOC and some of my colleagues in the Senate, they want to regulate Mohila out of business. They don't like that it's the standing hook. By the way, some people at Mohila didn't like that I brought the lawsuit either. We just didn't care. I viewed my job as the lawyer for the state, including Mohila. So, but you got to just cut through it. But yeah, they, you know, look, if they were in the position, and I think this is scary, but important to understand, if they were in the position that we are in January, where we had the House and the Senate and the White House, they have campaigned on this. This isn't like me throwing something out there. This is where they're at, and they would have the votes to end the filibuster, pack the United States Supreme Court with at least four new justices, federalize our elections, grant amnesty to 15 million people here illegally, and add D.C. as a state. That's what they would do. So I only say that because there is a lot on the line. And why last Tuesday, it feels like a long, much longer than that, but last Tuesday was such a big day for the Republic. If it goes the other way, I'm an optimist, but if the Democrats actually got to do that, there is a shot clock, I think, that starts to run on our constitutional republic. It starts, and I don't know if it's 40, you know, when the buzzer sounds, but you get to that place, and let's just say we got, why not? Okay, you added four. All right, we're going to add 50. You know, and then you're a banana republic, sort of like when you have court cases that are brought to put your political opponent in prison that are falling apart.
So we're at the end of our time, but I did want to ask you one last question, because you mentioned the election, and you alluded to this before. How does the mindset change for you, right? I mean, it's 2 years of defense. Now we have all three branches. I mean, how do you look ahead and make sure that we're making the most of the time that we have?
Having a sense of urgency. I think that's the call, because we got 2 years for sure. And that may be all. You know, midterm elections are historically challenging for the party in power. We got 2 years to do everything we can to save this great country. And that's going to mean we got a historic opportunity with this tax, you know, the tax cuts are expiring. The Democrats opened the door for a lot of things that can be done by way of reconciliation now. And so it'll be up to the parliamentarian on some of these things, but I think we ought to be, I'm not going to speak for anybody else, I intend to be very aggressive on that. Judges, everything. We just have to have a real sense of urgency, because you just never know when things change. And as much as it was nice to get to know people and more time my first 2 years, I'm ready to go to work.
Well, that brings us to the end of our time. I mean, if you could join me in thanking the senator for spending a few minutes with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you both for an excellent conversation. Senator, we are envious of those boots. We appreciate your principled public service and your leadership in the